Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Riccardo Crescenzi. I am a professor of economic geography here at LSE, and I am your host for today. So welcome you all to LSE for today's event, which forms part of the LSE Festival, entitled How to Save the Planet, which is taking place, like, started Monday and will continue until Saturday, which is a series of events exploring what we can do to save the planet, its people and the environment from existential threats, from climate change to conflict to the deployment of artificial intelligence. In this event specifically, we will discuss green industrial policy, balancing national goals and global integration. I'll say, like, a few words on the specific angle that we aim to tackle in today's event in a moment. But I'm very pleased to welcome a panel of distinguished speakers and guests in the order of sitting and alphabetical order, Oliver Harman, Luis Hellem, Anna Valero, and David Willetts. And I'm also very pleased to welcome our online audience and everyone joining, of course, today. So let me very briefly introduce the panel. Oliver is a special economist and economic geographer at LSE's Geography and Environment department. His research focuses on urbanization, global value chains, and regional development, and is also a co-author of a very nice forthcoming book on green global value chains for sustainable regional development that we are co-authoring. That's right. So, Luis is a chief economist at CBI and a member of its executive committee. She shapes CBI's overall view on economic and fiscal policy, leads discussion with senior politicians and policymakers. And very importantly, her recent work includes leading research on UK's net zero economy. So you can see, like, also the close link with today's topic. Anna Valero is director of the Growth Program and professor in practice at the Center for Economic Performance at LSE and deputy director of the Program on Innovation and Diffusion. Her research focuses on sustainable growth, innovation, and she currently also serves as the industrial strategy advisor to Chancellor Rachel Reeves, having previously served as a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. And last but not least, David is a member of the House of Lords and president of the Resolution Foundation, the leading cross-party British think tank. And he served as Minister for Universities and Science and was a member of Parliament. And he previously worked at the Treasury and at a number 10 policy unit. So you can also see immediately, like, how we have possibly the best possible panel to address the topic that we are discussing today. Like I said, like, today's event is about, like, three key ideas: the green transition that connects, like, so well with the theme of the LSE Festival, global value chains, so the international dimension of how the green transition can be achieved on the ground, and industrial policy, that is the one of the public policy tools that can be achieved, that can be leveraged to get where we want to go. The key point here is that the green transition goes well beyond energy. So the green transition involves all sectors of the economy, manufacturing, services, but also involves skills, finance, as well as innovation. So it is clear that the green transition cannot be achieved in isolation. It's about all sectors of the economy, but it's also about not individual economies in isolation. That's about trade, foreign direct investment, and global value chains. In other words, it's about global connectivity, the global connectivity that is needed to bring the components that are necessary for the green transition to happen. Capital, so that's the funding, the knowledge, the know-how, and the technology, and the skills, of course, as we discussed. So that's what links all our keywords today. The industrial policy, therefore, needs to balance domestic capacity building, so how we build the domestic capability to support the green transition in all sectors of the economy, with international openness and what I would call strategic connectivity. So we need to reach out, we need to connect out, but given the changing landscape that surrounds us, we need to connect in a strategic manner. And this connectivity has very profound implications, not only at the national level, but also at the local level, when we look at local communities, when we look in a more granular manner at what happens in our economies, in our local communities. So the relevant policy mix goes beyond industrial policy alone, and it's something our panelists will discuss, includes investment promotion, involves education, involves science and technology, infrastructure, as well as regional development. So industrial policy goes beyond industry to be something that becomes a full embracing policy agenda and a portfolio of initiatives. Global integration, however, creates opportunities, but also geopolitical dependencies and strategic vulnerabilities that need to be taken into account. So LSE Research, this is how we will start with Anna, LSE Research can help inform these policies, can help shape these policies by using data, by using rigorous analytical methods to understand how these processes unfold across firms, across sectors, and across places, very important. So how is this panel going to work? Anna will start, David will follow, then Luis and Oliver. So we'll have like a nice structure with 5 minute statements, initial statements by our speakers, followed by 2 minutes for them to react to each other's statements. And then we will open the floor for questions from the audience here in the room and from online. For those on social media, for social media users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. I would ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will be made available, if there are no technical issues, at the podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. I'm reading the instructions I was given. As usual, there will be the chance for you to put questions. So just like let's let the panel make the initial statements. There will be plenty of room for questions. So following their initial statements, there will be a Q&A session from here and online. I will ask you to introduce yourself, tell us your name and your affiliation, both if you are posing your questions online or here in presence. But let's move on to the panel. Anna, the floor is yours. Thank you.
Thank you, Ricardo. And it's really great to be here to discuss this important topic. So I'm just going to say a few words on policy debates on sustainable growth and industrial strategy with a focus on the UK, how that's evolved, how our research has fed into that, and then kind of where we are today, what some of the opportunities and challenges are looking forwards. So as many of you who follow UK policy will know, there have been a number of industrial strategies and growth plans over the years. If you look, say, since the coalition government, quite a few different plans, sometimes an explicit industrial strategy, sometimes a broader plan. But beneath that high-level chopping and changing that many of us talk about, there's been some level of continuity when it comes to a focus on clean energy technologies. So, for example, energy featured in the 8 great technologies that David Willett set out as science minister. Clean growth was a grand challenge in Greg Clark's industrial strategy of 2017. There was then the 10-point plan for a green industrial revolution set out by Boris Johnson as PM. We then moved to the Inflation Reduction Act era in the US, and the debate kind of moved on to how can we compete, how can we compete when there's that level of scale and incentives being offered? We need to be smart, we need to be targeted. At that point, we then had Jeremy Hunt's 5 growth sectors, clean energy was one of them, and clean technologies were also part of the advanced manufacturing plan that he set out. So alongside this kind of industrial strategy evolution, of course, there were evolutions in climate policy too. And in 2019, the UK became the first advanced economy to sign net zero into law by 2050. So today, where we are today, we have a clean energy mission of this Labour government, clean power by 2030. There's obviously lots of other stuff that matters for net zero. But the topic for today, there's also an industrial strategy. And I would say this is more than industrial policy. It's a strategy. It contains skills and all those other policies that you mentioned, as well as perhaps more traditional industrial policy type subsidies or R&D support, etc. And this seeks to build on the related areas of strength in the UK in high growth sectors. And clean energy or clean technologies feature in that, but it's not only that. There's services like creative industries, financial services, other things as well. So that's great, but we're also at this point seeing a fracturing on the kind of green growth consensus, both internationally as well as in national debates. This is something that actually there was quite a lot of consensus on until recently. And also then in current debates, in part shaped by that, there's been a shift to talking about resilience. And when we think about the current context with the complexities of international supply chains, fossil fuel shocks strengthen a lot of the resilience arguments for clean energy and domestic capabilities. But of course, the new context creates new resilience challenges because, as we know, for clean technologies, there are other supply chain risks. And that's why thinking about interconnectedness, what you can do at home, what you need to rely on partners for is really important. And as recent analysis from the IEA highlights, China's dominance in certain areas is really quite high, particularly solar, for example, 85% of solar supply chain production capacity. So in this context, the question we're asking is, for industrial strategies, we have an urgent need for growth. We have national decarbonisation targets, which have associated investments. So how can you think about those investments and try and actually get some of the gains for supply chains, for innovation, for jobs in a domestic kind of boundary? So for any country thinking about industrial policies, where does it make sense to try and do that? And where does it make more sense to have international openness, collaboration, partnerships, etc.? And that's for trade, but it's also for innovation and other things. So that's the topic of this discussion. And that's what a lot of our work has been trying to inform. So at the CEP, working with colleagues at the Grantham Research Institute and CTEX as well, we've been doing analysis of a variety of different data sets, each with their pros and cons, to try and identify where the UK can focus, like with international comparative advantage measures, etc. And the argument here has been that green industrial policies, given the UK's strengths and investment requirements, should be embedded into a broader growth strategy that combines horizontal levers, other sectors, building them up. And we did a lot of work in the Economy 2030 inquiry, collaborating with David and Resolution Foundation to try and inform this. But in a more recent green industrial policy matrix, we set out what we considered some key criteria for prioritisation, and then evidence on, across key technologies where there was some evidence the UK can play a role. So solar, for example, was not included in our analysis. So we considered opportunities for growth, so likely market size, comparative advantages of the UK in both trade and innovation, so how likely you are to access that market, and the likely economic benefits. And for this, we look at spillovers. So by looking at how innovation spills over within national boundaries and across them, that's another important metric. We then considered strategic importance. How important is a particular technology area for decarbonisation objectives in the UK? And then what are the kind of supply chain and resilience considerations on that? And then we considered the distributional aspect. So where are jobs? Are jobs going to be created from this? Where would they be located? And what's the regional spread of opportunities? So this kind of work doesn't just inform specialisation within countries, but also it can help inform, because of those connections, which partnerships to nurture. Very briefly, some examples of findings. For example, when we look at trade and innovation, there are signs of comparative advantages in areas like CCUS, carbon capture, usage and storage, nuclear, offshore wind. These are all subsectors in the UK's current industrial strategy. There are also, you look at broader areas, so we had a category decarbonisation of buildings. While overall we didn't seem to have a strength in that category, when you look at heat pumps, which is strategically quite important for the UK, we had a bit of a comparative advantage there. The patterns of regional specialisation are really appealing because, and I think this is consistent with work of the CBI, while a lot of innovation activity overall happens in London and the South East, when you look at the specialisation of places on clean technologies, that's higher outside of London and the South East. And a lot of that is due to natural capacity and legacy industries. And there are real opportunities for leveraging strengths in the UK's research base. This is like a core strength of the UK. We track innovation spillovers from science in universities into these technologies. And while Golden Triangle technologies, of course, are really important here, for example, we find in offshore wind, Manchester and Nottingham important for offshore wind, Southampton, Manchester for nuclear, and Liverpool and Newcastle for CCUS. So I think that this is work we really want to build on. And we do deep dives as well. We did one on adaptation technologies with CTEX colleagues, and we looked there also at services. So finance, insurance, professional and business services, core strengths of the UK. So really briefly on the current opportunities and challenges, I think I've hinted at, I think there is the opportunity now that there's a solid framework in place. I'm a little bit biased because I did work on it. But, you know, I think it's evidence-based. There's lots of policies, different levers, skills as well. There's a clean energy jobs plan that government also recently published. Clean technologies feature across industrial strategy sectors, clean energy sectors. That's a kind of very obvious one, but there's advanced manufacturing, where there's batteries, for example, advanced materials. There's financial services that highlight sustainable finance. There are connections and partnerships emphasized across this. So two examples, there's a Japan-UK partnership on industrial strategy. There was something, I think, this week announced on frontier technologies, including some energy technologies. And also there's the Kensington Treaty, which is a Germany-UK partnership, including on innovation and supply chains. But to finish on the challenges, this is really complex because of all the changes that we're all seeing in supply chains, the new technologies and the new requirements they have. I think current pressures on sectors as part of decarbonisation versus the, and how can governments be responsive to that, but also maintaining the strong signals to shape investment and innovation towards sustainability. And then finally, the challenge of longevity through the political cycle. So we've had so many changes, and the way industrial policy happens in the UK is aligned with the political cycle. So how can we learn lessons from previous examples and try and maintain that longevity, which will provide business with the all-important stability that they need to make investment decisions? Thank you.
Anna, thank you so much. David, please, wants to talk?
I think, yeah, shall we go down the line? Is that easier?
Yes,
so, yeah, lovely to be with you all this afternoon. So, Louise Hellam, I'm the chief economist at the CBI. And essentially what that means is that I speak to businesses up and down the country in lots of different sectors about what some of these policies and strategies are that government is implementing. And on the flip side, again, talk to government about, you know, what does the business environment look like? What are the policies and strategies that they would like to have as well? So it's trying to bring some of those real world conversations and discussions into this debate. And particularly as my role as chief economist is obviously to also think about what is the evidence for some of this kind of policy and some of the analysis as well. So there's kind of three points I wanted to make, kind of three areas I wanted to cover. The first one, as you happily kind of covered in the introduction, is that through our consultancy CBI Economics, one of the projects that we have done, and this is I think the fourth year in a row that we have done it, is to look at the size of the net zero economy in the UK. So there are lots of great growth opportunities, if we've heard about, for future growth in the sector. But actually, we were really interested to know what is the current size of that economy, what is the potential value that it's already creating. And I think we've been really excited by that work because it shows that this is a sector from its direct contribution and those spillovers to the rest of the economy that's already generating £100 billion worth of economic value to the UK economy and is supporting more than a million jobs as well. So I think one of the big messages that we wanted to show with that piece of work is that the net zero economy is already a big part of the UK economy, and it's a really important part of our national industrial base as well. And I think, again, as we've heard in the introduction, that is not just about the energy sector, that is about the contribution that it makes across manufacturing, across construction, across high value services as well. A lot of these businesses that are involved in this sector are not just some of those kind of big national players that you might have heard of, and again, some of those, you know, kind of big energy suppliers, but actually there's a whole network of kind of SMEs across the economy that's also involved in this as well. And one of the exciting findings behind the work as well is that on average, the kind of jobs that are attached to this sector are also really high quality, high productive, and therefore highly paid jobs compared to the average. So on average, they pay about £43,000 a year if you're working kind of full time in that industry as well. So I think that's the big important message, the first one that I want to say. This is not about kind of future projection. These are jobs and businesses that exist today, and they do provide that benefit in terms of high quality, high paid jobs as well. The second thing, particularly when I'm talking to businesses across all sectors around the industrial strategy, around growth, is the importance that energy plays in that, and particularly around affordable, secure energy. And that is really essential if we're thinking about increasing the growth in the country, if we're thinking about the success of the industrial strategy as well. This morning I went to actually like a kind of similar event at PwC that we've been working with them and a trade body called Energy UK with a piece of analysis that looks at what could the relative benefit be to the UK if we were to reduce energy costs in the UK and have them so that they were more comparable to our G7 peers, because that gap is kind of widening in terms of energy costs in the UK versus others. And that showed that if we had the same level of energy prices in the UK as in the G7, that that could generate £250 billion worth of extra value to the UK economy over kind of 10 years. And the consequence of having that gap between our international peers means that we are losing some of the energy intensive businesses within the UK. You know, you continually hear stories, I think there was kind of Denbigh Potteries the other day, around some of those energy intensive sectors that are moving out of the UK that are closing down. But also increasingly, when I speak to businesses, particularly if they're kind of multinationals and they're deciding on investment projects in the UK versus elsewhere, when they're looking at some of those benefits or costs of coming to the UK, they're actually deciding the UK is becoming more and more expensive, and they're making those investment decisions elsewhere as well. So that is one of the challenges that we think about within this debate. And I think when I talked about affordable, secure energy, I think we can also see that renewables are offering that long-term energy security where we're less exposed to those international fossil fuel prices. So increasingly we're thinking about affordable, secure and green energy when we're thinking about our energy strategy within the UK. And then the third point that I wanted to make, which again I think has been alluded to a bit in the discussion so far, is that whilst we have had a lot of these strategies, and like we say, they might have all been caused kind of slightly different things, there's been a broad consensus, like I say, around that transition towards a greener economy, a greener energy mix, which has seemed to start to break down a little bit in the last few years. And particularly when we're thinking about some of those investment plans that need to happen, you know, actually having that reliability, that consensus on the direction of travel, if that's breaking down, that makes those investment decisions a lot harder. And I think one of the messages through this for me, and goes back to that report that I mentioned at the beginning about showing the opportunities for people, showing those job opportunities, is that we need to make sure any energy transition within the UK is really managed well, and it's got that focus on people, on places, and building up that resilience in the UK economy as well. I think, again, as Anna mentioned, some of the work that we've been doing is looking at the clusters for the net zero economy in the UK, and it's really exciting to see where some of those kind of hot spots are. But actually, it's where we can also still tell that kind of national story. So we've got clusters in Scotland and the northeast, particularly around some of that energy supply and energy generation. But then in Yorkshire, Wales, the Midlands, we've got industrial clusters. London and the southeast, we've got clusters around professional services and financial services. And those elements are all really complementary to building up that supply chain and building up that broader net zero economy as well. And I think that, you know, one of the important things, like I say, is that this is widespread. But if you do look at some of those clusters, particularly on the kind of energy side, then some of those are located more in kind of coastal communities and areas that have previously gone through periods of deindustrialisation. So I think actually thinking about how we can invest in some of those areas that perhaps haven't had some of that investment for a while, I think that is really important to show the benefits of growth in this sector, and to then make sure that we do bring back some of that consensus within the UK, because actually, you know, the term net zero can become kind of politicized, but if you're reframing the discussion so that it's about jobs, it's investment, it's about growth, then I think that's harder for people to kind of argue against. And I think, like I say, the work that we have done, the analysis that we've done, but also those conversations with businesses really show how, you know, this isn't a choice between net zero and growth. This is just about how we make that energy transition as positive for growth, for jobs and resilience as we can. But it's where I think it can bring great benefits to the UK.
Thank you. Thank you, Liz. David.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity of being here with you guys. And we at Resolution Foundation work with the LSE on a whole range of projects. And this is certainly an area where we have a shared interest. Anna mentioned the history of this debate, and I have to say, and she touched on this, for me, the biggest single change by far has been the success of China's industrial strategy. And some of the hopes we had 10 or 15 years of being a major global player in some key technologies have basically been overtaken by the dominance of China. So a lot of these strategies, both in Britain and in some other advanced Western countries, look rather more defensive and rather less optimistic and global than they did a decade ago, because there's one country that has certainly delivered an industrial strategy successfully. I'd just like to touch on three angles. First of all, so you do have to be very rigorous about where the UK has comparative advantage, and the kind of data that Anna and her team collect is really helpful in giving some empirical heft to that. But as we know, we have advantages in offshore wind, partly because our continental shelf in the North Sea is not very deep and because of our experience of constructing North Sea oil installations. So there's clearly an opportunity for us there, though in a moment I'll touch on why we haven't quite seized it the way one might have hoped. We have other advantages as well. Because of those North Sea oil installations, we are... a great place to do carbon capture and storage. But another thing that's been talked about for a long time and has proved very hard to deliver in practice, and having served until recently as chair of the UK Space Agency, we sometimes underestimate the role that satellites and Earth observation plays in all this, and where Britain is particularly strong in the key technologies. The best methane tracking satellites are operated by the UK and can now collect much more information about specific locations and evidence about problems in Uzbekistan or wherever in a way that was not possible even a few years back. And although I'm doubtful that we're ever going to see a large number of data centres in space, I do think space-based solar power is very likely. That's a bit of the equation that makes sense. And the UK is one of the world leaders in trying to deliver space-based solar power. So we do still have some comparative advantages. Secondly, where it hasn't worked, and this is a vivid example of how policy has been placed blind, is in areas where we've obviously got an advantage, like offshore wind, and there was elegant work done by teams of economists in DESNZ and in its previous incarnations, where DESNZ always had many more economists than engineers, and their great achievement was the design of things like the Contract for Difference. But I can remember, even in my day in government, the discussions of Contract for Difference and how it operates rarely touched on the supply side, where who actually was going to be the players that took advantage of security, long-term markets and pricing. And the truth is, Ørsted is the biggest single beneficiary of an extremely sophisticated offshore wind policy in the UK. And if we had played our cards differently, perhaps had stronger partnerships with city financiers, we may have seen a British alternative to Ørsted, though it's been a good citizen and has put effort into here. And also, if you look at where in the North Sea, on our North Sea coast, the activity is concentrated, it's a pretty random distribution. There's some in Grimsby, there's some in Hull, where there's research linked to the university, there's some in Great Yarmouth, there's some up in Newcastle. There was never a place-based strategy for a location where you would have a cluster that was aimed to be a global leader. And there was never a transport plan that matched that. There was never an enterprise zone strategy that said this is the place it's going to be. There was never simply using the convening power of government to bring together the players and make it absolutely clear that this was the leading location. So we failed on place-based strategy. And then my third and final point, it draws on my experience of something I'm doing at the moment, chairing the Regulatory Innovation Office in DCIT. And our job in the Regulatory Innovation Office is to try to ensure that regulations don't stand in the way of new technologies and innovation. And here there are there's good news and there's less good news. I think that one of the examples of good news, which goes back to the Regulatory Horizons Council, the predecessor to RIIO, and is a great example of how public policy can itself deliver comparative advantage, is we have had a sustained program of investment in nuclear fusion. And in quite a few advanced Western countries, it just seems obvious that your regulatory regime for nuclear fission should also apply to nuclear fusion. The obvious thing for a busy minister to do is say, well, it's all nuclear, it's all got one regulatory regime. It was a serious piece of work by the Regulatory Horizons Council about 4 years ago that made the overwhelming case that fusion was so different from fission, it should not be regulated as if it is fission. And believe it or not, that itself already gives the UK an advantage, because it means that our regime is much more suited. We are constructing a regime, a regulatory regime, that recognises that fusion is fundamentally safer. There are other things we can do. We have, in through forms of genetic modification, you can certainly imagine the use of biological processes to produce jet fuel or whatever. And for that, we have a regime around contained use or deliberate release, in which was assumed, it was assumed that contained use meant a lab and deliberate release meant a field. You can very well argue, plausibly argue, that if these are organisms that, for example, die on contact with the atmosphere or above a certain temperature, that is a form of containment. So having the right regulatory regime for using biological processes to produce clean fuel is another area where we're trying to make progress. And then there's the more physical and manufacturing side of things. Robots, drones, drone deliveries, much less energy intensive and much more efficient than van deliveries, which we're again trying to progress. So I do think there's a prospect that through smart regulation, we can raise our game in green technologies. I am still fundamentally an optimist that Britain has great advantages here. But looking back, I think we will, in Britain and in other Western countries, reflect on the missed opportunities of the past 15 years that have been so skillfully taken by China.
Thanks, David. I will leave the floor to Oliver, and then I will try to bring...
Okay, good. Thank you, yes, and good afternoon, everyone. I realised that was going to be the end of the four here, and I thought this was a festival, or it is a festival, so I thought there should be music and some musical metaphor. So I have a modest back catalogue. I have a first album with Ricardo, which is about global value chains and how they develop, and now there is indeed this new album looking at, you know, how they can be greener as well, if anyone's interested in this. So what you're going to hear from me today is from those first two albums. I'm going to try and have some kind of conceptual singles with the other panelists as well. But I'm going to first open with a cover, which I believe someone's going to play in a moment. I thought this is a nice song. It sounds like an environmental song, but actually I think it's very much the opposite. It's about a man who got the paradise he was promised. The factory was gone, the shopping mall was under wildflowers, but he is miserable. So listen to what he misses. Don't necessarily look at the video so much as the lyrics I'm interested in you hearing, and then I'll ask you when to stop if possible, or I'll come up and do that. We'll be right back. Thank you, and I hope that was a nice little wake up. So yes, he sings, you know, if this is paradise, I wish I had a lawnmower, and I think that's David Byrne at his finest. A few lines on, he also kind of mourns the microwave, saying, we used to microwave, now we just eat nuts and berries. And I think this is kind of calling against this kind of paradise that people often think about when they think about greening, you know, giving up appliances, foraging for nuts and berries, this kind of fantasy of going green, going backwards, and it fails, right? At least it fails in this song. As does, I think, the mirror image, which is the fantasy of kind of doing everything ourselves. This, you know, he talks about the microwave in the song. But in 2009, this design student in Britain tried to build a toaster, right? And it kind of is it's the opposite side of this, that we would be mourning toasters in Britain if we tried to go alone. He tried to build this toaster from scratch. He picked this £4 Argos toaster, picked it apart and found there was 404 pieces made of 38 materials inside, and he attempted to find 5 of them in the UK to kind of build this toaster. He ended up going to this like disused mine in the Forest of Dean that hadn't been used since 1945, was up this mountain in Scotland looking for mica, was in some dump in Manchester looking for plastic. You know, these were all materials that we didn't necessarily have in the UK to build something as simple as a toaster. In the end, it cost £1,000 rather than £3.94, and there was huge environmental degradation as a result. And I think it's easy with green industrial policy to talk about a lot of these complicated things and think about what is available within the national boundaries, but actually we can't even do so something so simple with the inputs available in our geography. So that's kind of one thing I want to share with you. And if you remember anything from me, think about that toaster today. So yeah, the green transition isn't built by going backwards. It isn't built by going alone. In our work, Ricardo and I will argue it kind of runs through international investment, through these firms, through global value chains. And we see this by who's kind of committed to net zero. Of the largest multinationals, 62% of them have active net zero strategies, which is higher than the percentage of national governments, which is higher than the percentage of regional governments. National governments is 58%. Regions and cities is 29%. So in a way, a lot of these policy discussions are led by multinationals. And if government doesn't catch up and consider this and engage with them, that's what's going to be driving these things. An important kind of note is that these multinationals can be these drivers for greening as well. I think some examples, you know, when foreign firms acquire plants in Indonesia, they see their emissions intensity drop, actually. You often hear about this pollution haven and this kind of people wanting to you know, pollute elsewhere, but actually we see much the inverse in the data. This from this first album around global value chains, you know, supply chains are some of the largest firms. They are half of the global industrial emissions. So actually attacking these kind of global value chains is an important part. Also, first collaboration with CBI, of the figures that Louise was showing, there's that kind of 100 billion net zero economy, over half is generated through supply chains. So a lot of it is not necessarily the direct impact, it's where these things connect through. We see this in Port Talbot. I'm somewhat aware of time. So Ricardo and I wrote about this in the LSE Business Review, so I'm gonna maybe skip over this example, but I think it's a really wonderful example. I would encourage you to go and read about how a lot of these things connect through to certain geographies and certain places. Because Port Talbot sort of has a lot of these assets. We're kind of speaking about some of these clusterings. It's where net zero is being built in some way. It has the first nature geography of the certain deep enough water for floating turbines in this open coastline. It has investment coming in from some of the Norwegian multinationals. It has investment coming in from Tata Steel. And it is the combination of these old kind of industrial assets that such as steelworks provides, as well as this investment, as well as its first nature geography, that allows now Port Talbot to be kind of this new green cluster in eco-steel. And that's only through its kind of geographical constraints and its heritage. And that's a little bit connects through to some of Anna's work, talking about, and it's preserving a lot of jobs as well, 5,000 jobs. And these jobs can be good jobs, greener jobs, if they're kind of delivered inclusively, which is what Anna, sorry, that was a bit too placed gently. But I would encourage you to read that. I'm interested in you. There's time for being questions at the end. So I just want to kind of bring it back to a little bit, Ricardo's and my work. A lot of what we argue and what we try and speak to, and is indeed also what the resolution talks about in their Economy 2030 work, you know, not necessarily doing climate policy at home. You know, it doesn't necessarily work, and it doesn't necessarily deliver the economic benefit at home unless you kind of engage more broadly. And this is this engaging more broadly is what we speak to, which is what we kind of argue is this green global value chain sensitive policy. It's global value chain policy that both is oriented towards the international, towards the globe, towards these this capital coming from multinationals. But it's also, as David was kind of indicating, it's like somewhere that is place sensitive. It doesn't necessarily look across the whole of the UK. It looks, okay, what can Port Talbot bring to this kind of conversation? And that's a little bit this balance of this kind of this session, these national goals met through global integration. And I think that's kind of important sort of takeaway. So yeah, that's my brief intervention. The lesson I want you to try and take away is in line with this song, right? The green future isn't going to be won by going back. It isn't going to be won by walling ourselves in. It's going to be won by kind of connecting with others, matching each place to the green functions and its geography can hold, letting those benefits transmit. Because if we didn't, we might end up like the man in that song, but with a slight change, right? It would be, in this paradise, I wish I had a toaster. And I realized I'd have to sing that once I'd written that, and I thought, you've got to commit to the bit. So anyway, that's for me. Back to you, Ricardo.
Thank you. Thank you, Oliver. And thanks also for the musical part. So, conscious of time, I'll start like opening the floor for questions. I have some questions myself for the panel. So I want to check first like the questions from the audience, like from you here. We'll have the mic coming around, like here at the front. So we have one question here and one over there, please. So we take anyone else? And another question here, the gentleman here. Okay, we take three questions. We see if there are questions online. I love my questions, and then we let the panel respond. Please.
Great, thank you.
Your name, please, and
yes.
Affiliation, if possible.
My name is Amrita, lovely to meet you. I specialized in climate policy at LSE during my MSc. I'm working at LSE now. This is more of a systemic question than ideological, because I appreciate it's gone beyond ideology, and it sort of pokes at the undercurrent of what I believe Oliver was getting at. The green industrial policy, UK or global in general, nationally, internationally, do you think it would work even if you do all of these very complicated research and these little interlocking pieces intersecting in different industries that you were talking about? Would it work still in the system that we have of late-stage neoliberal capitalism, or would you need to change the system or move forward to a different system that looks at something more than infinite growth on a finite planet, the results of which we are seeing now? I appreciate that's your buzzword, but you know what I mean. Or what would be something that research or you yourself would propose as an alternative?
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Advais. I'm an LSE alumnus. I'm now training to be a corporate lawyer in the city. I just wanted to challenge the credibility of the jobs argument in the long term. So Lord Adair Turner spoke at LSE a few months ago, and he pointed out that whilst clean energy production has high upfront costs of capital and labour, once these installations are put into effect, the marginal cost of production is very low. You don't need very many people to run a solar plant, for example. So my question is, you know, when we think about the jobs argument, is this actually credible and sustainable over the long term? Thank you. Please.
Hi, my name's Elmo. I'm with the Worker Climate Project. And I suppose related to that jobs argument, I'm wondering what the panel thinks is the role of trade unions in this process, both in the sense of the sort of top-down technocratic giving legitimacy to this policy and allowing it to work, and also what is the role of deliberating with workers that are going to be affected.
Thank you. Thank you. Do we have any questions from online? Kevin, can you read maybe a couple of questions?
Yes, we have a question from Jean, who's an executive LSE student, and they say, what about legacy industrials such as steel and chemicals, to which many net zero clusters are linked? How to prioritise public support and make the decision to either subsidise them or let them go? And we have a question from a civil servant who's remained anonymous, saying, when we talk about green industrial policy and green industrial transition, we focus a lot on what we're transitioning to and less on what we're transitioning from. Could you talk a bit more about what you see as the policy challenges and opportunities in moving between a fossil fuel-based industry to a clean energy-based industry?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I think the questions show how provocative and insightful the initial panel discussion has been. So I will not add my questions for now. I'll let the panel react. Who wants to start? Shall we follow the same order?
I'm happy to. Well, I mean, they're all brilliant questions. I mean, I can try and touch on each of them. I mean, first of all, the question, which I read as being basically growth versus degrowth, or the type of capitalist system we have, can that deliver when we're all driving forwards for growth? Well, I would say that given the urgency of the climate challenge, I almost just think there isn't time for us to think of how we change our entire system. This is a system we have. And actually, if you think about innovation as the driving force for growth, there are strong arguments, theoretical and empirical, that the net zero transition is about innovation. That's not to say it's easy, but if you can get the incentives aligned, maximize the opportunities where they're there, where the investable propositions are there, but also deal with the disruptions and transitions, I feel like this system that we have now and pushing forward is the best bet for actually addressing the climate crisis, but also for achieving growth, which is much needed. In terms of jobs, there were quite a few questions there on jobs and also trade unions. Maybe I just kind of put them together. There are quite a few analyses that talk about the different phases of the net zero transition, the types of jobs that are needed immediately and kind of later on. And I almost feel like you can't divorce that from broader discussions of jobs. I mean, we have AI that might take many jobs, it might create new opportunities. So I think what policymakers need to understand, both on aggregate and also spatially, is where these issues are really going to arise. Where will it be very hard for people to transition given these different sources of change? Net zero, just maybe deindustrialization, which has been happening in the UK even in the absence of net zero, and then technological change. So having a proper strategy on that, I think the clean energy jobs plan that the government set out is really good on specifying exactly what jobs are needed, where, and what are the different policies, including working with unions to make sure these are good jobs. I think that's a really holistic look at that. And finally, I mean, that links to the whole transitions. I think overall, on aggregate, there aren't that many jobs in the UK that are directly in fossil fuels. But clearly, this is a really big issue in certain places. And that's why having proper transition plans, learning from the mistakes of the past, but also good experiences in other countries, perhaps, like having place-based policies to ensure people can access new opportunities and deal with that disruption, is so crucial.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, so I thought your first question is interesting, and I think probably sat here as representing the kind of CBI and probably what most people would represent as, you know, the embodiment of capitalism. I'm sat here talking today about the opportunities in net zero and the growth that brings. So I don't think that, like you say, we necessarily have to see those things in conflict. Actually, it's about, again, like Oliver said, actually businesses are one of the bodies who are really engaging in this discussion, in this debate, and leading the way in many ways. So I think actually that already shows some of the response from the industry, and actually, again, where they're leading the way, it's in that innovation, it's where you can make these efficiencies, where you can add most value to the economy and things like that as well. So I think hopefully that should be a positive sign within this debate. I think Anna's touched on some of the kind of job elements, which I completely agree with, in terms of it's like, how do we make this transition and how do we think about reskinning people? I think the question around what are we transitioning from is an important one, some of the policy challenges. So, within our membership, we do have, some of the oil and gas companies and things like that. And I think, you know, none of the businesses that I speak to, aren't invested or don't see this transition. I think there's a question about what is the speed of it, how do you do it in the best way? And I think, again, that is particularly where it's important to have that focus on place. And actually, if you're thinking about you know, the oil and gas industry and you're thinking about kind of offshore wind, actually a lot of those skills are very similar. So it's about how can you grow some of those areas like in offshore wind at the right pace that you can take those people from oil and gas and put them into it. It's not that you're kind of shutting down one too soon to move into the other. And also, I think just within the energy mix that we've got in our economy, and I do think that that diversity of sources is really important, again, for our kind of resilience, for those sustainable sources. We know that it's going to take a while to transition for that anyway. So, I mean, I think the argument that you, you know, kind of shut off the North Sea now, etc., kind of misses the fact that that just means that we will be importing more energy from elsewhere. That's actually probably going to be more negative for the climate in terms of emissions and things at the moment. So I think it is thinking about what is that timetable, what is that pathway into transition.
Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, I mean, on the jobs question, Adair, as always, is very good on the long-term trends. And fundamentally, electric motors are more efficient and less complicated to make and operate than diesel and petrol engines. However, when you try to assess the job intensity of the transition, things like retrofitting houses with better heating systems and better insulation is a massively labour-intensive project that's going to take 20 or more years. So I think the transition to Adair's paradise, let's call it that, in the future is going to take quite a while and could be very labour-intensive. I also wanted to comment on the legacy question, because I thought that's very interesting. And there is a lot of there's a lot of path dependency in all this, and understanding the paths that have got you to where you are is so important. And so one path dependency is North Sea gas. And, of course, the focus is on oil. But in reality, one of the reasons for our very peculiar energy pricing system and the reason why electricity is so expensive is trying to preserve a viable gas infrastructure and a gas modality. That's the... And that goes back to the gas supplies and North Sea gas and shifting to natural gas. And the great challenge is whether, to what extent, this infrastructure can be used for hydrogen. You can't; it's very hard to do move to hydrogen incrementally, and it's a much smaller molecule. But there is a program already underway of taking our current gas infrastructure and replacing the old piping with modern plastic piping that will be suitable for hydrogen. So eventually we can get there from our current regime, but it's messy. And the other one, and look, I do have regulatory issues always in my mind at the moment, and it is fascinating. We also have a very large infrastructure of electricity pylons. We know surprisingly little about them. We don't know what condition they're in. They've not been properly inspected for decades. And sending people up to inspect them is a dangerous and tricky business. One of the arguments I'm currently engaged in is trying to persuade the CAA that drones inspecting pylons is a very useful green policy, and we should make it a lot easier. And the risks of a drone accident are trivial compared with the gains of using drones to have a proper map of the capacity of, and safety and structural security of our pylons. And again, it's areas like that where a bit of smart regulation can contribute to a wider green and industrial strategy objective.
Thank you, David. Oliver, please.
Yeah, I can be quick, and they're all going to be coming from the new album. So I think it's an important question, right? I think we get this a lot, like within the kind of economic paradigm in which we live. I think we speak about this a little bit in the book. It's a bit of a cop-out, but you know, in terms of the economic and the environmental efficiency, this seems to be the best within the paradigm in which we are. There are people that of course will argue against the neoliberal capitalism, but that's not necessarily my area. I think that's a different, oh indeed, we should have another panel on that, right? I think on the point on jobs and the labor intensity, I think it's of course important, but it was interesting, your framing was a lot around the kind of energy related jobs, but there's a lot of work that Ricardo and I are doing, and Ricardo and co-authors, looking at these kind of non-energy related sustainable green activities. Like, for example, I'm doing some work in Rwanda at the moment, you know, electric motorbike factory. This is somewhere that is going to be quite jobs intensive, that looks very different from a solar panel in which you spoke to. So I think there's the other side of the green transition that is maybe somewhat missed out. I unfortunately haven't done enough thinking on trade unions, but that would be a an important consideration. And the final thing, this kind of transitioning to and from, I think we've spoken a little bit today about the UK in aggregate, but when I was going deeper into my fellow panelists' work, a lot of them do consider kind of different regions and different geographies and the different value addition and exactly where you're going to and where you're coming from, because that's going to be really different from the northeast in Scotland to Cornwall, right? And I think I'd advise people to look at this work, because I think it's really interesting and important part of this discussion. It isn't necessarily just UK's, you know, green industrial policy or any country's green industrial policy. It's all of the different kind of geographical units with all of their different natural capital and all of their different kind of, you know, historical industries that's going to be drawn from in different ways. So I think there's a lot of kind of nuance and variation to that last question.
Thank you, Oliver. I think we are running out of time, so we need to finish sharp on time. I think we have covered a lot of ground. I also had lots of questions that I will ask our panelists later, but I think there is an important message that comes from this discussion that is about innovation. So how innovation can be an important part of an industrial strategy, a core part of an industrial strategy and the way forward in terms of green transition. We need to reflect also on the role of innovation, not only in terms of mitigation, like low energy, but also in terms of adaptation. That is something that we need to take into account. How do we transform our economies to adapt to the consequences of climate change? But I think there is an important message in terms of we don't see a conflict between innovation, green innovation, and job creation. Job creation that takes place and good, high-quality jobs that are generated outside and beyond the energy sector. So what comes, I think, from all our speakers is something that tells us, okay, there is a lot that can come from all sectors of the economy and their effort to contribute to the green transition. That's why an industrial strategy needs to move beyond an exclusive focus on energy to embrace the whole of the economy, and that's where job creation opportunities are. Also, an industrial policy needs to have a place-based dimension, because when we think about the jobs that are created, but also the jobs that are destroyed in all big technological shifts, the geography of job creation and the geography of job destruction do not overlap. So it's very important to think about policies that target the generation of jobs where they are needed the most. And that's the place-based dimension of an industrial policy that is about innovation and jobs at the same time. All of these, I think that's an important point that came from what David said, with a supportive regulatory framework. So regulation here plays a key role and needs to be designed and reflected upon in a way that is systematic and systematically linked with a green industrial policy and its objectives. I know that's a very poor summary of an amazing debate, but please join me in thanking our speakers today for this insightful discussion. Thank you all at the LSE and online for being with us today. It has been an amazing event, at least from my standpoint. However, it's not the end. There are lots of more exciting events coming up this week at the LSE Festival, so please take a leaflet, check the LSE Festival program online to see more events coming up, as well as a very interesting exhibition on the ground floor of this building. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.